largest gathering of revolutionary socialists in this country right now. And the largest socialism that we have ever had in the ISO. Wonderful murals along the walls here, by the way, are not part of the hotel decorations. These phenomenal works of political art were made by Mike Alowitz from the Labor Art and Merit Project, and we thank him. We thank him for, in such an ugly world, bringing a little bit of political beauty. I do want to, we have so few victories to acknowledge and celebrate. I want to just ask Lee Wengraff from the ISO and the Campaign to End the Death Penalty to come up here and make a very important announcement.
Tonight to talk about how we can continue to build the fight against Bush's war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have a victory to report against Bush's war on the poor and on people of color here in this country, and against a victory in our fight against the death penalty and the racist criminal justice system that they've been speeding up, filling death rows, filling prisons. We finally have a victory to report, which is that Ryan Matthews, who was on death row in Louisiana for 7 years for a crime he didn't commit, he was 17, he was black, he was innocent, when he was set up and railroaded and funneled right onto death row after a 3-day trial, Ryan Matthews walked out of prison yesterday and he's...
give us a poem. We just wanted to acknowledge our audience tonight. We have has joined us tonight and will be speaking tomorrow. Last year's Green Party gubernatorial candidate from California, Peter Camejo.
For having invited me to speak tomorrow. I'm going to be speaking about the 2004 elections and the Greens. But first, I'd just like to thank the International Socialist Organization for the great work they did to help my campaign in California in the recall election and for all the wonderful work they're doing on a whole series of issues. And I just want to remind everybody that the position of the International Socialist Organization on the war in Iraq is the position of the overwhelming majority of humanity. It is Kerry and Bush that represent a tiny minority in the world. Our position is the overwhelming majority.
appropriate to begin this rally against war and empire with a poem from a man who is not only the poet laureate of South Africa, but a man who did time breaking rocks on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela, who was part of what Ronald Reagan, may he rest in great discomfort, what Ronald Reagan referred to as a terrorist organization, the African National Congress. We'd like to invite Professor Brutus up here. He's been an inspiration to many of us, to myself personally, 20 years ago at Northwestern, and became a revolutionary then. I have not turned back, so we have him to blame. I ask him, no, it cannot be his fault. I ask him to come up here and read a poem.
Thank you. It is a privilege for me to be part of this great occasion and this great crowd. I am delighted with your energy and your enthusiasm and the evidence of your commitment to the struggle for social justice. This month we remember the students, high school students mostly, who died in Soweto, shot down by the South African police, who were marching in the name of a heroic young man. Some of you I know his name. Steve Biko. Someone. Steve Biko died at the hands of the South African police. And ironically, the day of his death, and the day which we remember, was September 11. And so there is that kind of conjunction in time, as there was, you know, with the death of Salvador Allende, who was also killed on September 11. So we pay tribute to Steve Biko, to Allende, to all those who are part of the struggle. And so I read this short poem as a tribute to Steve Biko, the others who died in the struggle, some of them on Robben Island with me, some in the other prisons of South Africa. And we remember those who are dying now at the hands of U.S. imperialism in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo, in other places around the world. That too is part of our struggle, the struggle which we will continue until we achieve justice for people all across the world. We gather to remember those who died for freedom. We remember Steve Biko and the students who died in the mud and the slush of Soweto. We remember those who died in other parts of the world in the struggle for freedom. And together we commit ourselves. Together we declare. We will remember, we will endure, we will continue until we have achieved freedom for all the peoples on the face of the earth. Freedom for all the peoples on the face of the earth. Thank you.
part of our responsibility as a revolutionary socialist in speaking truth to power, we have an obligation to bring the voices of people who resist, including from among the ranks of the military, to the attention of people. And even though the American government won't acknowledge their existence, we need to hear. And there is a beginning, only the beginnings of that movement. And we are so thrilled and proud to have Michael Hoffman, a veteran of this Iraq war.
On March 20th of last year, I participated in the opening shots of a war that was sold to the American people on three reasons. Three reasons that in my unit fell apart before we even went into Iraq. A week before my unit even went to Kuwait, my first sergeant, a 20-year Marine Corps veteran, the son of a Marine Corps sergeant major, came in front of us and addressed all 120 enlisted men in our unit and told us, "Don't think you'll be heroes. You are not going to Iraq to find weapons of mass destruction. You are not going to Iraq to capture Saddam Hussein or make Iraq safe for democracy. You are going to Iraq for one reason and one reason alone, and that is oil." We went in there knowing full well what the real stakes are, but we had our own personal stakes. Those were to go over there and make sure all of our friends came back alive and in one piece. My unit accomplished that. Unfortunately, over 800 Americans were not that lucky. And now this war continues, in spite of the lies that have now been proven that were told by the Bush administration. Lies that go beyond the one that they're now showing to be false in the 9/11 Commission. Things like what the Bush administration stated that was, "We were more prepared for this war than any other military conflict in American history." If that is true, I am very glad I wasn't part of those conflicts. Examples of this abound. One prime example is the idea of the body armor we keep hearing about. What they're talking about is ballistic plates. That each soldier is supposed to be issued two of these, and this is one of the greatest advances in personal defense for a soldier that you could ever create. These will stop AK-47 rounds and save lives if everyone had them in the correct amount. Instead, many units had enough to supply each service member with one. Some had none at all. And the problem is that if you had one, there were times when you were better with no body armor than just simply one piece of ballistic armor. Because if you were wearing that plate in your chest and you get shot in the back, that round will travel through your body, hit the ballistic plate, ricochet, lose most of momentum, and go tumbling back through your body, turning what would probably be a serious but non-fatal wound into instant death. And then other things like the armor-plated Humvees that go to Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root employees but are not provided for American troops. Troops that are paid minuscule amounts compared to the humongous salaries paid to these people. And these people are doing jobs that should be getting done by American troops. National Guardsmen are being used as free labor for private contractors, increasing their own profit quota. These are all things that go on there. And then when the troops come home, they face even harsher realities. Most come from working class, minority families, lower middle class. They come from the slums and ghettos. Many are not even American citizens. And what happens when they come home? When I returned home, I saw my father almost completely disabled from working over 20 years at the Bethlehem Steel, a company which no longer exists. Bedridden at times because of a degenerative disc syndrome in his upper and lower back. His company closed and the government took over his pension. And the first thing they cut was his health benefits. My parents were left wondering if they pay the mortgage or they get my father's pills so he can make it through each day. It doesn't end there. VA benefits are getting cut left and right. I walked in from my own personal VA examination, and when I asked about depleted uranium, the doctor laughed at me and said, "What, are you trying to make more paperwork?" These are the realities, and it gets worse every single day. Bush is going to continue cutting benefits, and I have no doubt that Kerry will do the same, basically stabbing his own veterans in the back. This is the man who stood in front of Congress and said, "Who wants to be the last man to die for a lie?" Now he's asking numerous American troops to do that all over again. And we see more and more atrocities coming in from Iraq. What happened at the Abu Ghraib prison is not accidental. It's not a few soldiers not following orders. This goes from the top down. You have military intelligence going in there and playing on the emotions of these soldiers. These soldiers are guilty. They did something wrong, but the people above them knew what they were doing. They played on the fears and emotions of these soldiers. They told them, "American soldiers are dying because we don't have enough intelligence. You need to save their lives. You need to do everything you can to make sure we get actionable," is the word they used, intelligence, that we can use against them. And you have to remember, while they are telling them this, Abu Ghraib prison was being mortared almost every single night. And they were basically telling them, "Save your own life. Torture these people. Do whatever you can to get this information from them." And that's what they did. And now the ones who are above them claim they know nothing about this. Well, if they know nothing about this, they failed in their job as military commanders. So they are either guilty of telling them and allowing them to do this, or they are guilty of not doing their job. Either way, they need to pay for what they've done wrong. And now, finally, we have the June 30th turnover date coming around. And what is that going to mean for the average American service member over there? Absolutely nothing. They will still be there, whether the UN puts their stamp of approval on it or not. Because one thing we need to realize is that U.S. troops in blue helmets are still U.S. troops that are underpaid and under-equipped and should not be there in the first place. And the violence that they're subject to is only going to increase as the Iraqis realize that this June 30th turnover date that they've been promised means absolutely nothing. Instead, all that's going to happen is Paul Bremer's going to leave, and Negroponte, who is himself a war criminal, is going to take over. And we will have the second largest military force, which is mercenaries, made up of war criminals themselves from the United States and other countries, many of them SOA trained, are going to simply take over. And now you will have a war criminal responsible for many of the atrocities in Vietnam and the Iran-Contra affair is now going to be in charge of an army of war criminals. And I cannot even imagine what can happen underneath that group. So now we will just see a continuing escalated violence against the Americans and all other people in Iraq. So what is the option? There is only one option left. We cannot put a UN stamp of approval. We cannot continue to have a U.S. presence in Iraq. We need to bring the troops home now.
Troops out now! Troops out now! Troops out now! Troops out now! Troops out now!
Anybody who's heard Shuja speak has probably cried and been inspired to do something. Shuja Graham was on death row in San Quentin in California. He's been an organizer for decades. He was a political prisoner then, and that has only inspired him to fight even further and inspired God knows how many thousands more to fight and become revolutionaries, become radicals, and try and change the world. Shuja Graham.
Today. Look at me now, San Quentin. Look at me now, Buckley. It's talking about the grassroots movement. My brothers and sisters, friends and comrades who are here tonight. I appreciate it from the profoundness of my heart that you are here tonight. Because you are the makers and the determined factors whether we win. As Martin Luther King said in his great speeches, we're thankful to all the great pilots who traveled through the great clouds and brought us down. The pilots who trapped the aircraft and got us down to where we at. But where we would be as a people if we didn't have a ground crew to receive us. So tonight, my brothers and sisters, I thank you all for being here. This occasion would be nothing without you all. And members of the ISO and my brothers and sisters of the movement who have pushed me and encouraged me, and my brother here who have gave me the inspiration, and my sister who have pushed me on, and all the great members of our movement who have encouraged the old condemned man to fight on. I want to thank you all tonight. Tonight, the dead man not only walks, but he's going to talk it. For a few minutes. My brothers and sisters, it's been a long struggle for me as an old former death row person, and I've come a long way. But I didn't come that way by myself. I'm here today because of people like yourself. Determined to make a commitment and make a commitment with an attitude that wouldn't quit. And they put pressure on the state Supreme Courts to make a determination because they felt. I got to hold this thing up. Okay. But we all right. We all right. Because we're my brothers and sisters here tonight. But I want to say, and I mean this, you know, I've been a part of the 60s. I grew up under the influence of the Black Panther Party. I grew up under the influence of Martin Luther King and all the movements. And that movement have did a great service to me personally and have did a great service to our movement as a whole. So in honor of those who have served and sacrificed and gave their lives to our movement, I would like to say thanks to those and those who are still, like myself, a survivor that is here tonight. I want to say that I've been a committed person, and I'm glad to be a survivor. For many years, I lived with a guilt trip because all of my friends have went to the wayside, and I have to make new friends again in our movement. And I want to thank you all for encouraging an old condemned man to go on and continue to be a young socialist. Who am I? I'm not just a socialist, I'm a death row person. I'm not just a death row person, I'm a prisoner. And as long as there's prisoners in America, I will always be a prisoner. As long as there's hungriness in America, I will remain a hungry person. As long as there's homeless in America, I will remain a homeless person. I speak on the behalf of the voiceless and the people who cannot speak today. My brothers, we are here because we are trying to create a socialist movement. Socialism in our time is not only possible, but achievable. Many of the guards, when I went to death row, and I want to try to be real quick with this here, when I went to death row and how I was beaten down and much of the things that have been going on in Iraq today have reflected my whole life. Many of the things that you've seen when you've seen the film of Attica reflected my life. That picture told everything. I've come many times and spoke to you all, but I think that picture of Attica and what you have been seeing in the ride today and the yesterdays is going to reflect a greater picture for you all. You're going to all put it together, and we're going to all stand up and fight against those tyrannies, those aggressions, those peoples who create the racism and the oppression in our world, the imperialist movement that is going on. We have to stand up against imperialism like never before in our life. And as a condemned man that went to death row in 1973, a day that I always remember, I went to death row not because I was a criminal, my brothers and sisters. I went to death row because I joined a movement to stand up for humanity. And I paid an awful price. But I'm proud to stay here today as an old socialist who is fading, but trying to hold on. I have no regrets about my stand and the stand of the people who stood the island. Brothers and sisters who was in California, the Kevin Cooper Brigade, I don't want to punch you out and make you all as special. Bang! But my brothers, you are special. Because I went in the 90s. A lot of people feel that the Kevin Cooper thing grew overnight. But the Kevin Cooper thing didn't grow overnight and become a household name. It came out of an experience and a dedication that started back in the 90s. When I went to California and Cameron and the people from California and the young students from Berkeley University that stood up, as I traveled in and came in on the plane, they picked me up and took me out to the battlefield. I said, what we have to do? Say, Sue John, there's only one thing we have to do. We have to stand up and fight, hear your shoes, hear your battlefield equipment, let's go to work. And to my beloved brother, my socialist brother, Cameron, who stood up. I remember when I come down and the young ISO members in the campaign to end the death penalty took me in, gave me 5 or 6 keys. I said, oh my God, what I'm doing with all these keys? He said, you gotta do what you gotta do, come when you want to. He said, just be ready to fight when we call on you. I said, that's enough. I said, but Cameron, I got 5 or 6 keys. He said, no, you have 7. That's a comrade. And during that struggle, as we got off the plane, and the most wonderful thing that happened during those courses of events in Kevin Cooper's case, our people were so dedicated and so committed. People took off from their work. This is what we're talking about, commitment and attitude. People took off from work, made up different stories why they told their bosses they couldn't be there. Because it was standing up against racism and capital punishment in America. And as a former death row person that is being persecuted by the United States government, I feel solidarity not only with the Iraq people, but I feel solidarity with the people that was in Guantanamo Bay and many of the prison guards. And we're going to have to speak up and not be afraid about what is going on in the world. But we got to speak up and speak up on our political conviction, what we feel and what we mean. But we got to do it with an attitude that won't quit. Bush said, bring it on. I say today to you, my socialist friends and comrades, Bush, bring it on. We as socialists will stand up and we will not seek revenge, but we will seek human justice and we will fight for a better world. Socialism. Stand up. Two more minutes. No peace, no justice.
No peace.
That's right. It's all right. I'm so excited, you know, like, hey, what you all did is your fault. And I thank you for being your fault, because if you wouldn't be here, I wouldn't even be up here myself. I'd be talking to myself, and I do that a lot. But I'm happy to be talking to you all, young socialists and comrades. And as a former condemned man and been on death row and been subjected to the worst of everything, I want you all, as you leave here, I want you to try to remember a few things. As I struggled in my life in the 60s and 70s, and now I'm into the whatever they call it, I can't even remember the 2400. But I just want you all to remember, I'm a survivor because of you. I've survived because I've had an attitude. And most people say, but Sue, what you did and what, how did you survive the brutality and the oppression? I say, I went to war with a conviction. I didn't go to war and fight against America and fight against prison brutality and fight against racism based on emotionalism. I went with a socialist conviction. I went with a revolutionary conviction. I'm a revolutionary socialist. I stand here today with my socialist brothers at ISO, and I say, we're going to move on. We're going to make a better world. And not only a better world is possible, we're going to achieve that better world. I'm not worried about achieving it in my time. I have patience. I want you to achieve it in your time. As an old guard, y'all can't help me too much. My emotions and my feelings has been deeply disturbed by what I've faced in my lifetime. But I want to say to you all, everything that I've faced in my life, I've faced it with pride and dignity. And with your support, I have no regrets. Only regrets that I have in my life, I wish I would have started when I come out of my mother's womb, resisting and opposing what we feel. My brothers, as I leave you, and I think this will be the last time that I will ever use these statements. And it was when I went to South Carolina, and David Hill was scheduled to be executed, just like Stephen Oakland, when we all, our ISO comrade, was on the plane, and we felt really bad, and we had to leave at a time when Stephen Oakland was going to be executed. But Mike and rearranged, Mike Stark out of Maryland said, I'll stay back, and I said, it's important, and I appreciated it, and then Mike stayed back to try to overlook things and show our spirit as young socialists and movement peoples. And I'm thankful to him, but when I went to South Carolina, the ISO and the campaign brought me down, and we lost that battle as well. But we lost just a battle. We didn't lose the war. It continues. And David Hill was executed, and as we were going to the prison, we was talking to him on the phone, and he had been isolated from all the other prisoners, and we was going down, and I felt and reflected on when I was a young man and facing death penalty and not knowing that I was going to live or die. And David was full of energy and spirit. And it's something that he was presenting to him that he should be able to reflect on, and they gave him a couple of thoughts that come from someone that I don't really know. But David looked over the thoughts and the readings, and he said, I would like for this to be said at my funeral. And it goes something like this. Sometime in our life, we have to meet a few wrong peoples before we meet the right ones. In my lifetime, he said that I've been on death row. I've finally met the few right peoples, and they have changed my life and changed the lives of others. He said the most happiest of peoples doesn't necessarily have the best of everything. They just make out with the best that they have. Happiness comes to those who cry. those who suffer, those who have served, and those who have tried. For only they can appreciate the importance of those who have touched their lives. I, as a former death row person, and a young socialist, and a proud socialist, and I'll die a socialist, I say to you all, my brothers and sisters, I've had a tremendous life of struggle, sacrifice, pain, but it's been all worth it. Because when I leave here, I'm gonna leave here as no one else would probably want to think of. I've lived and I've struggled, but when I leave here, you'll be crying. That's the commitment that I want to make to my life. When I come out of my mother's womb being swears and oppressed, I should have been a rebellious black man, but I wasn't. But life and experience have taught me to be rebellious for the just purposes. Today, I continue that rebellious, but in a righteous and noble way. I want to say to you all before I leave, when you all was probably born, you were probably crying, and everyone around you was probably smiling. Go on out, my brothers and sisters, and live your life so that when you die, everyone around you will be smiling and thankful to the greatness of your life and the commitment that you have made to your humanity. You all have been great. You all have been a supreme servant of our humanity. I stand here as an old socialist, and I stand with you all. Continue your struggle. Continue your participation. Dead man not only walks in America, but he talks. The peoples in Iraq must be free. The peoples in Iraq must see America as strange liberators. But the peoples in Iraq have justifiable reason to rebel against the invasion. To the ISO, to my comrades of struggle, thank you all for pushing the old man onwards. And I can say this with confidence. No matter what happened in my life, my last thoughts will be of wonderful people like yourselves. I want to thank you for pushing me onwards, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to stand. San Quentin, the dead man walking, the dead man going to sit down, but he still has a commitment that won't quit. You've always said to me, we're going to beat you down, we can kill George Jackson, we can kill Malcolm, we can kill all the struggle people that have stood up. You're just a nobody trying to stand up. Today, my brothers and sisters, you have made me feel as somebody. And I don't know what to say outside of that, because that means more to me. After being beaten down and told that I was a nobody, that means more. Fight for socialism, end imperialism, end capitalism. Stand up, have an attitude that won't quit, have an attitude that is so dominant that everybody would listen and say, here lies a great fighter who fought so well that they deserve to be in the line of the kingdom of righteousness. You are the righteous peoples. You are the supreme servants. You are the makers and the determiners whether we win or not. Go on and determine a victory for us. Thank you, my brother.
Doesn't count them, but there are thousands of dead Iraqis, and they all have names and faces, and we mourn them. Our government does count the dead American soldiers, and as of this morning, there are 835 dead American men and women as a result of this quest for oil and empire. And they all have names and faces, too. And we are very happy to have with us here, though we are very saddened as to the reason why he is here, the father of one of those dead soldiers, Fernando Suarez de Sola. He is from the Guerrero Azteca Project. He's here from California, and we'd love to welcome him here, Fernando.
Buenas noches a todos. Les pido disculpas, voy a hablar en español.
I apologize, I won't speak in Spanish.
No need to. El día de hoy, en la mesa de trabajo de en la tarde,
hoy, mientras teníamos una de las discusiones...
It's your fault. Today, while we were having our discussion this afternoon,
se acercó la mamá de un muchacho que está a punto de irse a Iraq.
The mother of a young guy that's very close to going to Iraq approached me.
La señora está angustiada porque su hijo se va a la guerra.
And she's in anguish because her son will be going to war.
Y nadie en el gobierno le ayuda, aunque es el hijo único de la familia.
And no one in government is willing to help her, even though that's the only son in the family.
Y así como esta señora, diario, se acercan a mí diferentes padres y madres de familia.
And in the same way that this young woman approached me, every day, different parents and fathers and mothers approach me every day.
Es por eso que la organización Military Family Speak Out ha crecido al grado de que hoy somos cerca de 2,000 familias en contra de la guerra.
And that's why the organization Military Family Speak Out has grown so much to the point that we are today more than 2,000 families.
Military Family Speak Out y el proyecto Guerrero Azteca por la Paz no nada más venimos a hablar.
Military Family Speak Out and the proyecto Azteca por la Paz, we just don't come here to speak.
Nosotros estamos actuando.
We're acting. Where?
Estamos tomando las calles.
We're taking to the street.
Vamos al Congreso y empujamos a los congresistas.
We go to Congress and we push the congressman.
Pagamos cientos de dólares de teléfono de hablar diario a la Casa Blanca y al Congreso.
We pay hundreds of dollars in phone bills because we call Congress and we call the White House.
Y lo más importante, estamos yendo a las high school.
And even most important, we're going to high schools.
Porque creemos creemos que es inmoral que los reclutadores invadan los centros de enseñanza como son las escuelas preparatorias.
Because we believe it's immoral that military recruiters invade all the centers of education like the high schools.
Y tenemos que sacarlos de ahí, a patadas si es necesario, pero sacarlos.
And we have to take them out of there and we have to kick them in the ass.
Es vergonzoso que engañen a nuestros muchachos de las minorías hispanas o afroamericanas.
It is an embarrassment that they had to go
and lie and fool our young kids from the minorities, whether it's Latinos or African Americans.
Con promesas de dinero para la escuela y papeles de ciudadanía.
With promises about money for going to school or about promises about becoming citizens.
Para poder entrar a trabajar al gobierno o al aeropuerto, tienes que ser ciudadano.
If you want to be able to work for government at the airport, you had to be a citizen.
Pero para ir a morir en una guerra bastarda, no importa qué eras.
But to go and die in a bastard war, it doesn't matter to them.
Y tenemos que parar eso.
And we have to stop that.
Pero ya estamos metidos, gracias al Bush, hasta el cuello de problemas.
But thanks to Bush, now we are up to our necks in problems.
Tenemos a nuestros hijos muriendo en Irak.
We have our sons and daughters dying in Iraq.
Tenemos a los niños iraquíes muriendo diario.
We have Iraqi children dying daily.
Mujeres y hombres ancianos.
Women and the elderly.
¿Y todo por qué?
And everything why, because of what?
Por petróleo.
For oil.
Por dinero.
For money.
Pero nada por humanidad.
But not for anything that has to do with humanity.
Estos son niños de Irak en una escuela primaria.
These are Iraqi children at elementary school.
Es una escuela, no es una base militar.
It is a school, not a military base.
El 23 de marzo murieron 15 niños aquí por las bombas americanas.
On March 23rd, 15 of these children died because of American bombs.
¿Estos son los terroristas que dice Bush?
Are these the terrorists that Bush claims?
Los terroristas están en la Casa Blanca y en el Congreso. Y esos terroristas están creando enemigos.
And those terrorists are creating enemies.
Estos niños me recibieron con la sonrisa en la boca.
These children welcome me with a smile.
Pero hoy no sé cómo nos puedan recibir.
But today I don't know how they will welcome us.
Gracias al pinche Bush.
Thanks to the SOB Bush.
Please. It's beautiful that a lot of people coming here and speak about the socialists, speak about the justice and peace. It's beautiful. But we need to wake up. We need to stay in the streets. We need to gather the phone, read the letters, and push every day administration and say no more illegal occupation in Iraq. Free Palestine people and bring the hope now. When my son died in March 27, my life changed. I am catcher in 1711 and I deliver the newspaper. I lost my son, I lost my job, and I sacrificed my family only because my son told me one day, "Father, I entered the Marine Corps for to help the people, not for to kill the innocents." My son
not have opportunity for healthy people now. But the Father is here, and the Father is working for him. Thank you.
Year on March 20th, there was a debate inside the anti-war movement. It was a debate over whether or not to include the demand to end the occupation of Palestine that I'm happy that our organization, along with many others, fought to include as part of the demand in that protest. And many of the liberals argued that if we included the demand to end the occupation of Palestine, that the demonstrations would be tiny, that nobody would come, that it would drive people away. They were wrong. One of the most disgusting ironies of the 20th century is that the people who were near, to whom a genocide was committed, have now committed a genocide against another people in the name of the Holocaust, which is disgusting to us. And there's been somebody who's been a tireless campaigner for the Palestinian people for years. Anybody who's been to a conference over the last years has run into Rania Masri. She is a fellow at the Institute for Southern Studies. She's a producer of a recent film called About Baghdad, and she's here to talk to us.
Thank you. I have to confess, I wish y'all had a conference a few months ago when I really needed this energy. So, thank you. You know, there's one verse I wake up every morning and go to sleep every night thinking, and it's basically, we are many and they are few. But then I went to bed last night thinking, but who is the we that is the many when we say we are many? Who's the we here? Is it just we, the oppressed, the people of color, the low-income communities, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it in addition to that, that we have to add we the informed and we the hopeful? On top of all that, I don't think it's enough to be oppressed. I think, in addition, we need to know the issues, and then we need to actually believe that we can make a damn difference. Right. So, I just want to go through with you a few of the main issues that we know, or that I hope we know. The main issue is this absolute farce, this joke called the June 30th transfer of sovereignty. And all that will happen on June 30th is that we will be given an American dictatorship with an Iraqi face come June 30th. That this government will have no lawmaking authority, no authority over the US military, no authority to change the illegal laws passed by the US military, but thanks to the United Nations, it now has international legitimacy, which means come July, the occupation won't be an occupation, it will be an invited military presence. We know of the rise of the private military contractors, 20,000 soldiers of fortune accountable to their shareholders, who are growing in number and growing in stature in Iraq with no accountability. We know of the massacres in Fallujah, in Baghdad, in Najaf, and we probably anticipate the massacres to come tomorrow. We know of the misuse of language, this joke that we have insurgents in Iraq. We cannot have an insurgency without an authorized government. We have no authorized government in Iraq. They are not insurgents. They are fighters. They are resistors. But they're no insurgents. We need to recognize that language. And we have here Kerry posturing himself as just Bush light rather than as any kind of a Democrat. And then come to be, pretty soon we're going to have a request for $20 billion to continue this U.S. occupation because it cost us $6 billion a month to occupy a sovereign nation.
And, you know, I have to say, I listen to this and we read all this stuff every day, and it's reached a point that I'm numb. I don't know how many people here are also numb to the news, and it occurred to me how numb I was when a month ago a friend of mine asked me, he said, Rania, how many times have you cried over the massacre in Fallujah? Straight-faced, I looked at him, I said, not once. And that worried me, that I haven't cried. So I'm going to go through with you here just a few of the images that have happened, because history is not history. History is continuous. And we need to remember that although that George Bush continues to release detainees, and they're not prisoners, they're detainees from Abu Ghraib and from the other detention facilities, he continues to hold 10,000 to 20,000 detainees throughout Iraq, and we will not forget them. We need to remember that Fallujah itself was a detention facility in which 250,000 people were held hostage and were besieged, and more than 880 Iraqis were killed and more than 1,200 wounded. We need to remember that Fallujah remains besieged. Although it is not besieged by the U.S. military, it is besieged by the Iraqi army acting as proxy to the U.S. military. And we need to remember what actually happened in Fallujah. That we had a hospital completely destroyed by bombing, and a garage transformed into a clinic. And one doctor in this makeshift clinic did not even have time to mourn for his brother and aunt who were killed because he was too busy trying to rescue the wounded. We need to remember the woman who was shot in the neck and the unarmed father who was shot and killed in the back right in front of his house, whose children looked from the doorway and they could not even go to stand by their father because the sniper was still on the building across from the road waiting to shoot them. We need to remember the pregnant woman who was shot, whose unborn baby survived, an orphan. We need to remember, as much as it pains me, the U.S. sniper who said, quote, I killed a bunch of the motherfuckers. And we need to remember that it is the same racism that goes hand in hand to any kind of occupation, whether it is the Israeli occupation in Palestine or whether it is the European settlers who first came to this nation and they use the same language against the Native Americans. We need to remember that. And we remember General Kimmitt's comment when asked about the atrocities in Fallujah as witnessed live on Al Jazeera television, and he said, and I quote, change the channel. Change the channel won't change the situation. It won't change that we've had two soccer fields in Fallujah become mass graves. It won't change that we have families that did not even have the security to bury and pray over their beloveds because there continued to be sniper shooting overhead. Changing the channel won't change the 500-pound bombs and the cluster bombs and the sniper bullets and the depleted uranium. Change the channel won't change the fact that the Iraqi economy is being stripped and stolen piece by piece and given away to U.S. corporations and legitimized by this illegitimate government. Oh, and I mean the Bush administration here. And we need to remember that Fallujah is not alone. Fallujah is Iraq. And everything that happened in Fallujah has happened elsewhere in Iraq. And Fallujah is not only Iraq. There are other Fallujahs that unfortunately have become even less visible, that previously were barely visible and now have all but disappeared in our press. And they are the Fallujahs in Palestine. Ramallah, Beit Lahem, Gaza, Nablus, Al-Khalil, Qalqilia, Al-Quds, Haifa, Jenin. Every day, children, unarmed protesters, and resistance fighters are being killed by the U.S.-funded, U.S.-supported Israeli occupying army, an army that is providing training and assistance to the U.S. Army in Iraq. I remember 23-year-old Dia, who was shot in the chest
by an Israeli soldier in an unarmed protest and who died in the hospital. And I remember Ra'fat Abu Hasira, a member of the Islamic Jihad, and Suhail al-Hirsh from the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade, who were also killed. And I stress to point out their names because too often we, as members of the anti-war movement, only recite the names of the unarmed civilians. And we somehow forget to mourn those who pick up arms to legitimately defend and free their country. And then there's that infamous meeting between a student and a teacher, between George Bush and his teacher of peace, Ariel Sharon. And in that meeting, George Bush gave away what is not his to give away. And they agreed together that there will be no right of return to the largest refugee population in the world, no withdrawal from West Bank, no withdrawal from Jerusalem, no removal of the illegal Jewish-only settlements on stolen Palestinian land, no criticisms of the killings of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and Dr. Aziz al-Rantisi, no criticism of the 25-foot high apartheid wall that is annexing and eating up 50% of the West Bank. No criticism that Gaza has not been freed from Israeli military occupation. And no disagreement from Bush, says Kerry. And I have to say that there was no outrage in the streets in the United States to this meeting between student and teacher. There was no outrage from us. And I must confess, there was no outrage from me. I had grown numb to all this. One more slap on the face, one more hit on the head. But we have to stop this numbness. We have to find a way to continue to be outraged, to continue to be immediately and spontaneously outraged. We need that sense of outrage. I mean, maybe we've just become used to this onslaught, because in addition to what's happening in Iraq and Palestine, we see our own rights here in this country being stripped and torn aside bit by bit by bit. And maybe it just becomes too much. Maybe it just becomes too crazy, too insane. And it becomes just too difficult to even maintain our sense of hope. And maybe we need to create it instead of maintain it. And maybe sometimes it's easier to just say, you know what, fuck it all, I'm just going to go shopping. But then there's a greater level of insanity and a greater level of moral suicide in that kind of action. So then what do we do? I think it requires some time, some kind of spiritual growth, some time to remember that though we are many, we the many also need some time to create our hope. And we the many need some time to look at our slogans. And I have to say, as much as I agree 100% with bring the troops home now, that barely touches the surface. If all we are saying is bring the troops home now, that's not enough. That's not enough. We need to be demanding economic liberty in Iraq, and not only liberty from military occupation. We need to be demanding economic liberty, and not this junk that they're throwing down our throats called free trade. Right. The only thing that they're making free. Free trade, as defined by Bush, is what's yours is free for me to take. And what we need to be demanding is economic liberty and economic equity. We need to make sure that they will not allow to happen in Iraq what they are planning, which is the free trade agreement of the Americas on steroids. We need to be demanding democracy and elections, and not a transfer of sovereignty from the elites representing the rich and the ignorant in this country to the Iraqi elites representing the rich and the ignorant in this country. We need to speak up very strongly against a change from an Iraqi dictatorship to an American dictatorship with an Iraqi face. And on top of all that, we need to be constantly demanding context and not this binary models of good and evil, which sometimes even we get caught up in. Not every resistor is a friend of mine. And just because you're the enemy of my enemy sure as hell doesn't make you my friend. We need to be allies in where we're going, and not simply united against a common enemy. I remember one time I was sitting with some comrades and a friend said, you know, what do you think of Al-Qaeda? Aren't they doing good work? No. And just because they happen to be a reactionary movement born out of oppression does not make them a force against oppression. They're simply the other side of the same coin, so we need to be careful as who we call resistors and who we call simply other terrorists. We need to demand linkage and not false separation of issues, which means Iraq and Palestine are inseparable. And it's not up for anyone to choose. This is just the way it is. And like Sherry said, the folks that were opposing including Palestine did not come to the protest, sure, but people of color sure did, and we made up the difference. Demand the linkage between military warfare and economic plunder because they go hand in hand. Everyone who stands opposed to warfare must stand opposed to the World Trade Organization. We must stand opposed to the IMF. They cannot be separated. And Iraq is the most glaring example of the unity of economic globalization and military warfare. And we take it further, and we remember the torture that's happening in Abu Ghraib, and remember that some of the folks that committed that torture were correctional officers in Virginia prisons. Which means Abu Ghraib and the prisons here are linked, and we refuse to separate them. And while we're making all these demands, we continue to demand not only outrage, but hope. And in demanding that hope, I want to end with a verse from Suhair Hamad's latest poems. And anyone who hasn't heard Suhair Hamad, go check her out. She is brilliant, to say the least. And in her latest poem, she says, among many things, and I quote, "There is still love in us. The proof is that we are watching it die. There is still hope in us. Hope is there in my sister's eyes. There is still enough resistance in us to create a world where there is no your people or my people, but our people. Our people who kill, our people who are killed. I firmly believe that there is enough hope and love and outrage. What we need to do is sustain it and make it really contagious. Thank you."
In this country, Pravda, also known as the New York Times, wrote that there are now two superpowers in the world as a result of the largest protest, probably in the history of the world, when millions of people across the globe protested against the war before it started. We were reminded that ours is an international struggle against empire and against war. And that the White House houses the most hated man, not only in America, but in the world. We're very proud to have with us here tonight a comrade of ours from France, from the Ligue Communiste Revolutionnaire. He is the author of Eastern Cauldron, the Middle East, and In a Marxist Mirror. And we are thankful to him as well for intervening in our own movement last year when he wrote a letter to a discovered activist. We have Gilbert Achcar.
Comrades, I bring to you the greetings of my comrades, your comrades, of the Ligue Communiste Revolutionnaire. And I would say also the greetings of my comrades, your comrades, of the French anti-war movement. And let me tell you, because you are being told a lot about anti-Americanism in Europe and in France in particular, but you are familiar with that because by these standards, you are all anti-Americans in this room. Well, actually, the more the people of the world, the European people, the French people, hate George W. Bush, the more they love everyone opposing and fighting this government. And any one of you who has experienced talking to European audiences in the name of the U.S. anti-war movement can testify to that fact. I mean, there is very, very high admiration either for the fight you are waging in this country, and which is absolutely crucial and decisive for, I would say, the future and the present of the world, due to the role the United States play in our world. So, to speak after so many inspiring speakers is quite difficult, especially when you speak in your third language. But, well, let me start by this issue, since I will deal with Iraq mainly. I mean, the fact that the president of this country has announced that in 11 days from now, on June 30, Iraq will recover full sovereignty. Full sovereignty. I mean, you should ask for TV sets in the United States to be equipped with lie detectors. But they would blow out, you know. I mean, this is the bluntest lie I have ever heard coming from any ruler in the world facing a camera. I mean, compared to that, the lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or the connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, well, at least there are lies which could exploit some, you know, degree of uncertainty, some gray zone, at least in the public knowledge. But this lie about Iraq recovering full sovereignty, that's exactly the phrase he used, full sovereignty, on June 30. I mean, it's incredible. It contradicts so much the most blatant facts that how can someone just look at the camera, face the camera, and say it? And say it without any sense of humor. I've been told that's why Ronald Reagan is regretted. Think that Bill Clinton was almost impeached because he lied about his peculiar use of cigars. Well, what a world we live in now. Well, everybody knows, everybody who has the slightest knowledge about the situation, everybody knows what Michael said, that on June 30, the real transfer of power won't be between proconsul Paul Bremer and CIA collaborator Iyad Allawi, who has been designated by Bremer to the post of Prime Minister of Iraq. No. The real transfer of power, obviously, as has been said, on June 30, will occur between Bremer and the new proconsul, John Negroponte, who will have in Baghdad the largest U.S. embassy abroad. Well, Negroponte's expertise, as you know, used to cover the banana republics. Well, he will now have to adapt it to this new category, the oil republic that the United States is trying to build in Iraq. But actually, his task won't be easy. Actually, the prospects for Iraq's recovery of its sovereignty are indeed getting better day after day, not due to any goodwill of the Bush administration, definitely, but because Iraq has already become the worst nightmare of the U.S. ruling class since Vietnam. The prospects for U.S. troops to remain in Iraq in the long run, and even in the medium term, are getting thinner day after day. And whoever is in the White House next January will find it very hard, if possible at all, to maintain the U.S. occupation of Iraq. In the coming months, the overwhelming rejection by the Arab population of Iraq of any continued presence of U.S. troops on their soil will become even clearer than it is today, especially if truly free elections are held in January, as they were scheduled and actually as they were imposed by mass demonstrations of Iraqis in protest against Paul Bremer's plan to designate a constituent assembly of his own choice. As you know, the proconsul of the good empire, Empire Light, as an enthusiastic admirer labeled it, the empire that is to bring democracy and civilization to a greater Middle East of Muslim barbarians, or barbarian Muslims, Proconsul Bremer was faced just a few months ago by mass demonstrations called for by a Muslim Ayatollah and chanting as a central slogan, "No to appointments, yes to elections." Since then, the situation on the ground for the U.S. occupation kept deteriorating. Confronted with the two main insurgencies, whatever the name, of the last 2 months, the Fallujah insurrection and the southern insurgency led by Muqtada Sadr, U.S. forces had to compromise, and that's what they did on the ground. And this is a clear sign of weakness. The U.S. occupation is getting weaker day after day. And despite what John Kerry said, stupidly I would say, the likeliness that the U.S. managed to send more troops to Iraq is quite low. Well, the U.S. armed forces are already overstretched. But anyhow, sending more troops to Iraq at a time when the Pentagon is trying to take U.S. troops out of the streets of Iraq would make no sense. The truth is that the situation is ripe for a new major defeat of U.S. imperialism. And for this reason, it's absolutely essential for the anti-imperialist movement, for the anti-war movement, not to get distracted by the presidential elections. It is absolutely essential for the movement to keep its focus on Iraq and to enhance its activity before and especially after the November election. We can win and we shall overcome. Thank you.
the next speaker, I just want to let people know what will be happening in the aisles here. This weekend, you will notice, was not brought to you by Procter & Gamble or Philip Morris. The one thing in your life that is not brought to you by corporate America. It is possible to have flown people in from around the world, people who are comrades of ours, folks who are victims of police brutality and family members of the brutality of that the empire inflicts upon its own population here at home. It would not be possible with the generous contributions of the people here and our friends. And we do desperately need more money in order to continue this work. People will notice the rather impressive book room, the hundreds if not thousands of titles in there, that among the titles from Random House and Monthly Review Press and South End Press and AK Press and all the other presses, you will have seen a recent proliferation of titles from our own press. Not only our magazine, which has been a crucial theoretical tool, a theoretical weapon for a new generation of activists, but all of this that has come out in the last few months on a threadbare budget and a staff that I won't even tell you how few produce all of this, but it's not possible without more money. That is an unfortunate reality of the world we live in, and until we get rid of this system, it is going to take money to put out these books, to put on conferences, to have people travel around so that we can build a revolutionary socialist movement and be done with a miserable system like this. There are going to be slips for people to fill out if you'd like to be able to contribute via a debit card or credit card tonight. People can write checks to the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. It's a nonprofit, one of the co-sponsors of this weekend's events, and the publisher of our magazine. And speaking of our magazine, we have the editor here tonight to end our panel, Ahmed Shaki, founding member of the IFA.
It's customary to stand for guests, not for people you know. It's wrong to be polite in public. Anyway, comrades, friends, I will be brief, in part because it's a joke that works every time, and in part because I believe that this panel and the people who have participated on it tell us something not only about ourselves, but about the world. That is, that the crisis that American imperialism faces in Iraq today not only has enormous repercussions for the Iraqi people who bear the brunt of that occupation, but have repercussions to a plan that American imperialism has had of redrawing the whole of the Middle East, which includes, of course, Palestine, but does not stop at Palestine. And at the beginning of this crisis included redrawing the maps or the physiognomy of Syria, of Iran, and crucially, of Saudi Arabia. And the panel tried to bring together, with Rania's contribution, that question and the question of Palestine. But if it's about redrawing the map of the Middle East, it's about redrawing the map of the world, which is why France, Germany, China, and Russia are watching what U.S. imperialism is doing abroad. And in order to do that, American imperialism has engaged in tried and true tactics, which involve the amassing of superior technology and force in the form of the best armed, trained, and commissioned army in the world. And as every single war, excuse the mic, and as every single war before that for American empire, the war abroad has produced victims within the armed services of the United States and victims in a war at home. And we are facing a complement of all of that. We also face a world in which, despite the biggest mass mobilizations ever recorded prior to the launching of a world war, the war was launched. Remember, February the 15th, around the world, the enthusiasm, the determination, the moral high ground, if you will, of the world's population against launching a war, but they did. And that, I think, is the shadow that we have lived under since February the 15th. The simple question, millions marched, they still went to war. Unspoken, and I think the letter that Gilbert wrote to the American movement was in... Was it before that? Your letter. Was it after February the 15th? It was after the war began. After the war began, not after February. Was, in essence, to try to answer the question, and we face that question today, what went wrong, or can we ever stop them? And I raise it openly and put it to the front because I believe it's a question that, if isn't on the minds quite formed like that, certainly was formed in my mind watching the Abu Ghraib torture. And the question was the following. Here is the most brazen, or amongst the most brazen acts of torture, systematic, carried through from Guantanamo into Iraq. And the link is there. And you can read Seymour Hersh, or you can listen to the testimony of the prisoners who left Guantanamo, who said the aim was humiliation, the use of dogs, the use of sexual torture, and so on. And the aim was humiliation, and it reappears. And you look at this scandal and say, will they go down? Will they go down? You watch a week, then 2 weeks, then 3 weeks of congressional and senatorial hearings, and then you see them come back together. Republicans and Democrats and independents, the two or three that I think exist, McCain, and anyway, they come back, and I think people are left to ask, the scale of the crisis that we face, or the scale of the questions that we have to answer in comparison to what we have at our disposal, and that the gap can appear so large that people begin not to be sure where to go. And I really want to step back from that and say something about that. Because it's in that context that the American elections are taking place. And it's in that context that naturally and understandably thousands upon thousands and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people will see in the end of the Bush administration a possible solution to the scale of the crisis that they face, that's how they may well approach the election. Our case, though perhaps harder to make in that context, has to be, and I believe will be shown correctly to be, and this isn't about my position was correct and therefore, I feel better. I don't. But the reality of the world is that the war in Iraq has been the outcome of 20 or 30 years of restructuring of American imperialism that included a bipartisan agreement, which included at the head of it the reactionary elements of the administration and, quote, the liberal elements, agreed on one thing. We must bring back American imperialism militarily. God bless him, he's gone. Ronald Reagan, under his tutelage, that was done. And secondly, economically, and into the 21st century, to combine the economic with the military wings in order to reestablish American imperialism. It's bipartisan, which means it will not end in November. It may take different form, but we are in this for a while to come. And that really is point number one. Point number two, well, it says point number two on my list. Point number two, that because it is unilateral, it isn't simply a matter of policy, but is something that grows out of the perceived needs of American capitalism and imperialism to survive and to outdo its competitors in the 21st century. Which means to say, or I mean to say by that, that mass demonstrations, pressure, meetings and so on, express an opinion, but will not be enough to slow the juggernaut when it comes to meeting the needs that they have to maintain their system. I say that for a simple reason, because if we saw it simply as demonstrations against the war and see it as a contest, really, of wills between us, the opposition, and them, I think we misunderstand the whole process by which policy has been changed in this country, and American imperialism has been defeated in the past. And the relevant subject has been raised before, and that is the question of the war in Vietnam. Despite the fact that they went to war, overcoming what appeared to be great odds in opposition, they have today even greater odds in maintaining their hold on Iraq than they did 6 months ago. And those difficulties will continue to grow. Those difficulties will not only continue to grow in terms of their ability to hold on to Iraq, but in terms of convincing the American military and the American public that they are fighting a war for anything but oil and regional stability and regional dominance in the region. It means that I think we are faced in the coming months with some difficult tasks of attempting to revamp, reorganize, and regroup an anti-war movement that is daunted in a sense by the scale of its task, but not by the rightness of the issue that it is taking up. That is to say, today, to go out and argue against the war is 100 times easier than it was 6 months ago. The question really is the confidence of people to mobilize, to take action, and around what question, and especially in the context of the elections. I believe that, therefore, our emphasis has got to be on attempting to deepen the roots of the anti-war movement in connection with the struggles at home, that the connection between those two elements, the struggle abroad and the struggle at home, have to be brought home. And that the one thing that the elections has brought clearly into being is that you have the closest two candidates on the key questions of the day relating to the war in Bush and Kerry. Both pro-free trade, pro-globalization, both pro-war. It does raise the question, I believe, of having to go out from here, from an audience in which we generally, bar a few debates over the weekend interest, we are talking to people here who largely agree on those questions, on the question of the anti-war, but not even just that, on the question of how to organize around it. Our task, I believe, coming out of this socialism, is to go out and try to reconnect, to reorganize with a much, much larger layer of people who are not convinced on exactly what to do or how to do it, but to say we are drawing, as the perennial word goes, a line in the sand that says we will continue to act against war and occupation abroad and against the war at home, and are capable of building a movement that exists, that is unorganized, is more diffuse today, but is larger, I believe, potentially, than the demonstrations of February the 15th. It's blunted today by the elections, but if it doesn't emerge before the elections, can and must emerge with greater force after the elections. And that is really something that we have to do. Finally, I want to say two things about the ISO itself and something about our contribution to this anti-war movement, because I think that one of the things that Fernando raised, that the talk of socialism is good and fine, but we have to talk now about certain practical questions. And I agree with him completely on the question of the practicality of the questions we must raise. I want to say one thing about the connection between socialism or our socialist organization and the movement. And that is that the role that the ISO has played and can play is simply to connect or make the connection between the particular issue at hand, the war, racism, and empire, and tie it to a system, and tie it to a system which will continue to bring wars and racism and attacks on working people, and say we fight on this front as part of an overall fight against a system which we believe must be overthrown and must be changed. That is the connection that we make. And I say genuinely that that is a connection that I believe can be made to the American working class as it exists today. Multiracial, multilingual, men, women, straights, bis. It exists today as a class that has suffered 30 years of continuous assault by a ruling class that does not even remember the slogan, An American Dream, without wondering how it was accepted in the first place. That, I mean that. Whole layers of the American working class today are open to that. They do not have political experience of day-to-day organizing. Unions and associations have been retreated. But the level of anger that exists, the level of skepticism about the existing order, the level of willingness to listen, I believe is at a higher point than at any time. And we keep saying it. It seems from year to year that it's a higher point, but I do not see how you could live through the last year and not add to the list 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people who are open to a political message. It's in part why Ralph Nader is getting the kind of showing that he's getting in the polls. It has to be. I believe that that is an audience that we, as a socialist organization, have, and we, as a movement, have, and it's up to us to try to make the connections deeper and stronger and build a movement in this country that takes us back and makes the movement of the 1960s look good. Look good, but that we can build a movement that begins to challenge class rule at home. Thank you very much.